Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with William Binney, an insider who served in the National Security Agency for 37 years, rising to the rank of Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Reporting Group at the NSA. We'll discuss the nature of the PRISM program that is the subject of the latest leak and how much the taxpayer is getting swindled by multi-billion dollar secret programs that don't work. Then we'll speak with world-renowned media theorist and technology columnist Douglas Rushkoff, the author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. We will discuss his article at CNN, Edward Snowden is a Hero, and the extent to which most of what we say and text on cell phones or write on computers is being recorded and passed by big data servers like Google and Facebook. We will examine the difference between our willingness to give up all our data to corporate big brothers in contrast to our objection to the government doing the same thing. Then finally, we'll speak with George Packer, a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. We will discuss his profiles of Americans living in the new Gilded Age, in which the 99% are increasingly aware of the economic and social impoverishment affecting their lives, but find it difficult to see a way forward because the institutions and means by which people can organize and redress the growing disparity and injustice have been compromised and corrupted. And joining us now is William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. And you had a bit of problems at the end, did you, in terms of not agreeing with the extent to which the mission of the NSA was not to solve problems, but to keep the money flowing?
Yes, I did, and that was basically because they had multiple billions of dollars ready to spend on a program that was going to solve or was supposed to solve problems that we had already solved, and so they had to get rid of us. They couldn't tolerate that because then they wouldn't be able to justify the multiple billions that they wanted to spend.
Yesterday, I spoke with the former CIA officer Bob Baer, who used similar algorithms to the PRISM program that's now in the news. He was hired by the United Nations to look into the assassination of the president or the prime minister of Lebanon, who was blown up by Hezbollah. And they got the appropriate court orders to get the phone companies in Lebanon to give up all the metadata. And they searched through that metadata and found the Hezbollah assassins. But the point he was making, Bob Baer was making, is that this PRISM-type program only works after the event, not before. There's no magical bullet. There's no algorithm that can predict the future.
They don't have one, no. That's correct, yeah. But the PRISM data gives them an awful lot of data to work with to try to organize to use current tasking on the existing collection systems to look at the activity of suspicious or known bad guys in the network.
Well, I guess the broader question, though, just following on from what you just told us about the program, that you'd already solved a problem, yet they want to spend billions more on a problem that was already solved. How much, then, is the ratio between, because Thomas Drake, a whistleblower, got prosecuted for blowing the whistle on another NSA program that didn't deliver?
Yeah, that was the same program.
That was the same program. Well,
yes.
So give us a sense of the ratio between things that work and things that don't work.
The cost, you mean?
Yeah.
The cost to develop the Thin Thread program, which is the program we had, was about $3.2 million. So it's $3,200,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the attempt to develop the other program was called Trailblazer. So the attempt to develop that was, my understanding was a little over $4 billion, but I think Tom Drake felt that it was probably double that.
So in the context of Booz Allen Hamilton, a contract that's literally across the street from the NSA, their annual income, I believe, is like $5.8 billion, 98% of which comes from the federal government. The question is, and given the revolving door with the former head of the NSA McConnell being on the board of Booz Allen, and Booz Allen in turn is owned by the Carlyle Group that was started by another revolving door insider, Frank Carlucci, former National Security Advisor for President Reagan. The impression you would get is that there's a tremendous amount of secrecy that may not allow oversight over what exactly we're spending all this money on. So that's the heart of my question.
Well, you're absolutely right. There basically is no oversight. The courts and the Congress basically say they are doing oversight, but they aren't really. What they do is they come out to the NSA or other agencies and they get briefings. So in other words, they receive what information the agencies want to tell them. Okay, so unless they have a whistleblower inside that agency, they don't know really what's going on. So the only basis they have is to believe what they're being told by the corporation, the heads, the leading managers in the agencies.
So who is a public? Who is an advocate for the public, for the taxpayer?
There is no advocate. I mean, when they're down there saying downtown in D.C., they're trying to say that they've got all this different oversight that looks after our interests, when in fact, when you take a close look at it, for example, the courts, if the FBI works with NSA to get a request for a warrant, the courts are totally at their mercy in terms of the information they're fed, because it's done in secret, for example, with NSA. The FISA court does everything in secret. So the only input they get is from what they're told by NSA and the FBI, which means that they can tell them anything they want, and they have no basis to challenge any of it. They can ask for more information about something, and they can create that and give it to them, but they can't challenge the basic information, when in fact they really need a way to do that, because in August of 2002, they found out, and it was published in the local news reports, the FISA court found that the FBI misled, or basically falsified evidence, to the court to get at least 75 warrants. Well, if they knew that, then they knew they were being lied to, and what have they done to try to correct that situation? The answer is nothing. Right, so far this year, they haven't denied any warrant requests. So there's no challenge at all there. So there's really no oversight. And the same is true with Congress. They have no real foundation to be able to challenge any of the basic information that those agencies tell them. I refer to that as technobabble bamboozling Congress and the courts.
Well, already these contractors are getting, what, about a one-third of the $70 billion intelligence budget?
Oh, at least, yeah, I would think.
Yeah. And we don't know what this is for. I mean, one of the things that I found disturbing from my conversation yesterday with Bob Baer was that this young CIA analyst who ended up working for the NSA and then for Booz Allen, he originally was paid like $30,000 or something, you know, government employee at the CIA. And then he was poached by Booz Allen, who offered him up to $200,000. But Booz Allen sells his contract to the government for $1 million. So not only are they making billions out of dubious software and algorithms and mysterious programs that we don't know anything about that promise to save us from a terrorist attack, but on the other hand, they're also taking all of these government-trained people who get a government top-secret security clearance and then marking up the value of their employment, you know, fivefold, tenfold.
Yeah, that's right. We called it corruption in our fraud, waste, and abuse in the complaint we filed with the DODIG's office. And they eventually, with those two cases, they eventually did come out with a report in early January of 2005. But it was pretty much held secret, and we didn't know what was in it until just late last year when it came out on the web. But it was 98% redacted. So, right. But it was clear that they agreed with the charges that we laid against the NSA, which was fraud, waste, abuse, and corruption. And the reason it was redacted so much is because the evidence they actually listed as some of the stuff that was going on there, and it was just too embarrassing to NSA. So they redacted all that and issued that in the public, but internally in the government, they limited distribution of that report also, so that it couldn't be questioned by Congress or anybody else.
Again, I'm speaking with William Binney, who was 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the technical director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the NSA. And that you had, how many thousand of people under you in that group?
Well, there were about 6,000 at it. I didn't manage them. I just was a technical mentor for them, basically.
Right. And this is really covering the globe. This is where the rubber meets the road, isn't it?
Right. Every technical issue in the world, yeah.
So how serious is this PRISM thing? Because I'm of the opinion so far from what I've heard that it may be more of a swindle than it is in terms of an encroachment on our civil rights.
Well, yeah, the government pays for the data that they get from those companies. So they that increases their bottom line, you know.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that PRISM, that compromise there really doesn't do anything. I mean, after all, and they've been saying downtown that it's affected our ability to the terrorists are going to do something to change, and then we won't be able to follow them, and that's simply nonsense. I mean, the terrorists have known we've been monitoring all these communications anyway from at least the late 90s. So that's, you know, almost 15 years that they've known about this. So the point is that just publishing something like that in the press in the United States, saying something that the terrorists already knew, isn't going to change what they've already decided to do based on what they know. You know? So if the effect is going to be zero.
So, but what about the effect on Americans who are swept up in this vast Hoover of metadata?
Yeah, they are trying to justify the collection of everything about U.S. citizens, as well as about trying to go against foreigners to find terrorists too. They're trying to justify it by saying they have to do that to find the terrorists, and that's just absolutely false. Okay, there are two very simple techniques they needed to do, which is what we did, and we had zero difficulty following terrorists or anybody else. One was what I call the two-degree principle. If you have a terrorist or a known bad guy, that's something you want to watch. And if who he communicates is like 1 degree away, who he communicates with is like the direct communication, that's 1 degree from him. Then you look at that person that he communicated with and look out at who they communicate. That's the second degree. And what that does is that forms your zone of suspicion. All right, and then what you do is look to see what evidence flows over that over time to see if you can validate that some of the second-degree people as well as the first-degree people are really a part of that terrorist network, in which case you would make them targets and then move that two-degree principle down another layer. So if you see what I mean, it just keeps moving and shifting as you discover things. And the other thing you have to do is monitor the sites in the world that advocate jihad or some sort of violence against the Western civilization. So that basically, doing those two things would eliminate even to have to copy the rest of the 7 billion people in the world. You would just throw it away. You wouldn't have to manage it. You wouldn't have to build places like Bluffdale to store all the data, the content, as well as the metadata that you're collecting. The entire industry would be much less than it certainly is today.
So a critic mentioned to me in an interview yesterday that the NSA's job is to look for a needle in a haystack, and what they've done to do in taking, you know, all of these contractors and all of this money since 9/11, this vast influx of money, what it has in fact done is, in terms of finding a needle in a haystack, it's just piled on a lot more hay.
That's right. That's what made the haystack orders of magnitude larger. And so it's made it so much more difficult to find the needle that they're actually making themselves more dysfunctional than not.
But they're making a lot of people rich, the government insiders.
Oh, yes, that's for sure.
Right.
There's so much money involved, and so many millionaires have been made already from the money that we've borrowed to pay for it.
Right, but this is money from you and me. This is taxpayer
That's
money.
Right. That's right. And or else it's money we've borrowed, which means we're also going to pay the interest on that, as well as the money that the principal.
From the Chinese.
That's right. Or others, yeah.
Right. So what's your sense then, William Binney, on what it will take for the public to focus in on what we're talking about? Obviously, people have they're totally justified in being concerned about the Fourth Amendment violations, although the Fourth Amendment has long been shredded, and they're perfectly valid in their concerns about Big Brother. But they don't seem to be focused on how the raid on the Treasury since 9/11 and how their hard-earned dollars are being hoovered up by a bunch of Beltway bandits.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of that we could do is to try to make it known to the public what's going on here. That's the only spreading the knowledge of what's really happening here and what they're really paying for, you know. But I would also argue that they didn't just lose the Fourth Amendment, they lost the Fifth Amendment. Because the Fifth Amendment guarantees that you don't have to testify against yourself, when in fact the FBI has direct access to all this collection of email, and if they have phone calls, you know, and recordings of that, they get access to that too, directly. I mean, Director Mueller told us that with the email in his testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee on the 30th of March of 2011, and this ex-FBI agent, Tim Clementi, told us about the audio that was collected that they could get back to one of the Tamara brothers' communications, a phone call, to his wife. That if his wife, he said, if his wife didn't tell the truth about that phone call, they had ways of getting back to it, which meant they had it recorded.
Well,
I mean, this is being used against people. So you don't, it's not just the Fourth, it's the Fifth. And what that does is that affects people and how they relate to others, so that you're affecting the right to communicate, the First Amendment, that privilege too, with reporters or anybody else.
So the justification that the White House has for PRISM, which was exposed by this Edward Snowden, who's on the run, or he could even be in custody for all we know, this 29-year-old former technical assistant at the CIA who then got a contract to work for – actually worked for the NSA as well, and then ended up with Booz Allen and Hamilton, who have just belatedly fired him. The justification that we're getting from the White House is – that these are just phone numbers, that all they reveal is the numbers that were called, who called them, and how the duration and time of the calls. But clearly, the next step is monitoring the calls, right? And that requires
But first you would do a reverse lookup in the phone book, you know, to see who it is,
right?
Which is, you can do that on the web,
right?
You have a reverse phone lookup, and or you could look it up in the electronic worldwide yellow pages for companies and begin to get knowledge about who was participating in the communities you were building. Mm-hmm. So if I assembled every call that, for example, you made, so I could see your calling communities, what that would be called, and then I start bringing in information from the white pages and the yellow pages and things like that, and I start putting that information into your community, I can see if you call a medical specialist, like a heart specialist, over and over again, or, you know, as over time, say for over, you know, a year period, you're calling this doctor every other month or something like that, I can infer that you're having a heart problem. You know, I could even go into that kind of inferencing. Or I always use the case, if the Colombians wanted to smuggle some drugs into the United States, you know, first of all, they have to have a contact, somebody in the United States, like the Colombian person would be the seller. They have to connect with the buyer in the United States. So there has to be a relationship there, which would show up in your community. And then they have to have some way of transferring the funds, which would also show up in your community interaction, you know, transfer of money electronically or physically moving it, you know, that gets more dangerous. It's more easy. It's much safer to do electronic. And then they have to have a talk to somebody who will transport or communicate with them in some way to get that relationship. And that's another relationship. So you see those kinds of relationships that are necessary to achieve the activity that they're trying to do.
So in other words, just in closing, William Binning, how close are we to the total information awareness that Admiral Poindexter tried to shop some years back and got shut down?
Well, I think basically the government is now assembling the information, the basic information that it would take to create a total information awareness. They don't have the awareness yet, that is the software, the algorithms to go across all the information that they've assembled yet to make that total awareness real. But that's what the White House Big Data Initiative is about, to get algorithms that would go through this large sets of data, big data, and automatically figure out what's in there and what's important in there, and then alert people what that is.
Right.
So that's then total information awareness. And I think they're probably, they probably are at least 5 to 10 years away from being able to do that.
And that's what the Utah Depository is about storing everything until they get the awareness part. They got the information, in other words.
That's right.
The 10 years or 5 years, they'll have the awareness. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting conversation, William Binney.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William Binney, who was 32 years in the National Security Agency and 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the NSA and left in protest to the enormous amounts of money being spent on programs that were unnecessary and didn't work. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back to talk about why we accept the fact that most of what we say and text on cell phones and write on computers is being recorded and passed by corporate big brothers.
I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours. Oh, 1984. Come see, remember me.
Say that all might move around. You said it would last, but I guess we grow. In 1984.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Douglas Rushkoff, a world-renowned media theorist whose 12 books include Life, Inc. and Program or Be Programmed. He is a commentator on CNN and a contributor to The Guardian, Discover, and has also made the PBS documentaries The Merchants of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation. He advocates for digital literacy at codeacademy.com and teaches at New York University and the New School. And his latest book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. And his latest article at CNN is Edward Snowden is a Hero. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
And why do you think Edward Snowden is a hero?
Well, I mean, I think he's more of a hero against the machine, I guess, than I usually think of him as a hero in terms of national security issues and all. I feel like too many people as individuals and now our institutions really accept technology at face value and just employ it sort of blindly and automatically. And what that requires is, human intervention. You know, we need some human beings to stop and say, well, wait a minute, do we want to be doing this? And maybe the other humans should understand what's going on here.
Well, one of the things that you point out in your article, Edward Snowden is a Hero, Douglas Rushkoff, is this peculiar disconnect, a kind of a voluntary double standard on the part of most of us who accept the fact that these big data servers like Google and Facebook can disseminate to the databases and record and pass most of what we type on our computers and say on our cell phones and use this for commercial purposes. And that is, after all, why Gmail is free. It's not that this is a gift from a big corporation. They're getting something out of it. And yet we're up in arms about the government doing the same thing.
I know. I was kind of surprised. That's why, you know, if the president says we should have an open conversation about this, I mean, I feel like in some sense that's all that's been exposed here is the same kind of thing that, you know, the government says it's looking into about us. You know, no particular investigation was exposed, no content was exposed, just the process itself has been exposed. But yeah, I assumed this was going on the whole time. I mean, to me, this is just a confirmation of what I was hoping most people understood. But, you know, given the way people are up in arms and how classified this was supposed to be, you know, I guess this is new information for most people. But really, you know, a necessary education for people who, you know, who type email as if it's just going out into the ether. They don't seem to realize that they could be, you know, may as well be etching this into the side of the Parthenon for how long it's going to last and how it could be used in the future.
And it's amazing, though, that people write an email and say how much they like chocolate-flavored yogurt or something. And the next thing, suddenly they're getting ads for chocolate-flavored yogurt thrown at them. They don't make the connection.
Right, and that's the easy part. I mean, that's, you know, the simplest way this stuff works. That's not the, people feel somehow assuaged, I suppose, by the fact that, oh, well, the government's not listening in on our information. You know, they don't have to listen in on our information to know what it is we're saying, you know, or to know who we are. You know, when they're trying to determine whether someone's about to get pregnant or about to become gay or about to catch the flu, you know, or about to buy a car, it doesn't really matter what you're saying in your email. The kind of thing they're looking at is, you know, what sorts of websites have you gone to? How frequently have you made phone calls? The kinds of data points they use are not directly connected to the information that's gleaned from it. You know what I mean? It could be the change in rate of phone calls could indicate that you're going to get sick. The change in the diversity of email addresses from which you open email could be indicating whether you're about to get married or not. So they're not logical connections between data points and information about us. So when we're thinking about privacy, it's really, you know, they can figure out if you're going to be cheating on your spouse, not by what you're saying to your friends, but by data points that you may not even realize are statistically connected.
So again, Douglas Rushkoff, the author of the new book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. We discussed your book before and the notion that, I used the famous Winston Churchill quote, turning it on its head, never before in the field of human endeavor has so much been said by so many about so little. And it's the kind of the tyranny of trivia. And you see people sitting at lunch at a restaurant, four people all staring at their palms. Clearly, there's an enormous societal change underway and not necessarily for the better. But in your article, you talk about Snowden, the leakers, du jour's warning about a turnkey tyranny. So just elaborate on the idea in terms of how much we've let the evolution of our machines dictate the evolution of government policy and how it's affected society.
Well, it's interesting. It's machines plus profit, I suppose, plus corporate profit. I mean, because while, you know, you or I or our friends sitting and tweeting and sending messages may not be adding value to their lives by remaining in that state of perpetual distraction and perpetual interruption, they're creating tremendous value for the companies that are tracking this information. You know, the more time that we spend online, the more value we are creating in the form of data or big data for someone else. You know, we're not really the customers of these technologies as much as we are the product, or I suppose even more the labor force for these things. But the more time we spend online and the GPSs in our pockets, you know, the global positioning satellite software that we use for to find the best restaurants and whatever else, or to use our Google Maps and other things. I mean, those things are on all the time anyway. So we're also creating a data trail just as we move around with these things. Just being in motion creates a tremendous data trail. And if you know where a person is, how they've gotten there, how their movements have changed, you have tremendous. I mean, that's a more precise data stream than anything we could type in our emails. You do create a big data repository that does bring us very close, if not already there, to the kind of turnkey solution that Snowden is talking about. You have such a wealth of information about the entire population of people who are walking around with these things. I mean, it's as if we've, you know, injected ourselves with Mission Impossible, you know, silicon chips to track ourselves, except instead of being injected, we just bought these things. You know, we line up outside the Apple Store at night to get, you know, to get the next version. We hunger to be tracked in this way.
So it's not the UN black helicopters that are tracking it. It's our friendly Googles that give us our free email.
Exactly. No conspiracy required.
So what's your sense then of the other aspect of the story, which I've been covering, which is the extent to which is what's going on with Snowden, these programs like PRISM are also a huge swindle because of secrecy and because of the post 9/11 transfer of wealth from government hands or public coffers into private hands. There's been enormous, enormous swindles going on, and we simply don't know whether any of this stuff works, and it doesn't matter because, you know, there's no oversight and we can't even find out. I mean, that to me is a different form of tyranny.
You know, for sure. For sure. But, you know, it's funny. I'm actually interested also in the way that the entire machine is now going to be turned against Snowden himself. You know, he knows as well as anybody that everything that he's done has been tracked. And followed and pursued. You know, it's a fascinating situation now where we really have the agenda of technology itself, if you will, or technology of technology in business, actually superseding the human agenda. You know, we're going to see many more examples of human beings in one way or another caught up in the machine, and these are machines running on operating systems that we sometimes don't even acknowledge. So we have people caught up in the mortgage scandal, which is really, on the one hand, yes, it's human greed, but on the bigger sense, as I see it, it's a system that's gotten out of control. It's, you know, derivatives on derivatives and the way things are being traded. Or in the case of privacy, it's technologies that are being employed automatically rather than consciously, which is leading to, you know, a surrender of certain human agency in the face of big government. You know, or in the case of our kids and Facebook and Twitter, it's them surrendering their privacy and really things about themselves they don't even realize to companies because of an underlying operating system that they're not even aware of. You know, they're aware that they have all of this newfound agency because they can, you know, write things and write blogs and write tweets and say what they feel, but they're not really aware of the operating systems circumscribing all of this activity. You know, who are they really paying up to? So I feel like it's the same story being told again and again in different ways. You know, that the agendas and agency of human beings, you know, being surrendered in one way or another to operating systems and to technologies that we don't really understand.
Well, just in closing, Douglas Rushkoff, what can citizens do to free themselves from the machine? Do they have to go off the grid?
You know, I think on the one hand, it's a matter of just understanding that it's there. I mean, if you're going to live trying to escape the surveillance cameras at the 7-Eleven, you know, you're going to have a very hard existence indeed. But yeah, on the one, I think it has to do less with avoiding technologies than enhancing humanity. Using technologies willfully and by choice rather than in their default settings. You know, it could be as simple as having a cell phone that doesn't ring unless it's a member of your family who you've already checked or, you know, part of your VIP list rather than automatic calling. Or choosing consciously, do I want to be on Facebook? Do I want to be constantly updating in this way? Do I want my GPS on or off? It's really just choosing to use things consciously rather than accepting everything on its default.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, gosh, thank you, and thank you for what you do.
Again, I've been speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, who's a world-renowned media theorist whose 12 books include Life, Inc., and Program or Be Programmed. He is a commentator on CNN and a contributor to The Guardian, Discover, and has also made the PBS documentaries The Merchants of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation. He advocates for digital literacy at codeacademy.com and teaches at New York University and the New School. And his latest book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. And his latest article at CNN is Edward Snowden is a Hero. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about The Unwinding.
Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay.
Tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer, the rich get rich and poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Packer, a staff writer for The New Yorker who covered the Iraq War for the magazine. His book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, was named one of the 10 best books of 2005 by The New York Times. And he served in the Peace Corps in Togo, West Africa, and was a Guggenheim Fellow. He's written about the atrocities committed in Sierra Leone, civil unrest in the Ivory Coast, the megacity of Lagos, and global counterinsurgency. In 2003, Packer was awarded two Overseas Press Club Awards, and his most recent book is Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade. And his latest book just out is The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Packer.
It's good to be with you.
And yesterday I spoke with a former CIA officer, Bob Baer, about the ongoing leak from the NSA involving this young fugitive on the run. And most of the coverage, of course, is about the familiar argument of civil liberties versus national security. But what Bob Baer was saying is, since he's in touch with an awful lot of people coming out of the CIA and out of the special forces, they all have the same complaint, which is about this swindle of these contractors. And the new, not just the military industrial complex, but the new intelligence industrial complex. And he ended up by describing the situation as Nigeria on the Potomac, which I thought, since you've written about Lagos, might elicit a comment from you.
Washington's bad, but I'm not sure it's that bad. I'm not sure what he meant by Nigeria on the Potomac, unless it's just a kind of Wild West, everything is privatized, no one is accountable. Is that what he was getting at?
I think what he's getting at is that we have a system here of revolving doors, and that Booz Allen Hamilton is a classic revolving door, given that the former head of the NSA is now on the board. And it is, in turn, Booz Allen is owned by another classic revolving door company, which is the private equity company, the Carlyle Group.
Yeah.
So it's all of these insiders who have basically got their snout in the public trough. And this is a form of kind of right-wing welfare. This is a subsidized capitalism.
I mean, that's true. It's been going on for a long time. It's true in many sectors, you know, maybe most famously in the revolving door between Wall Street lobbies and finance committees on Capitol Hill. But, I mean, the numbers are staggering. Something like close to half the people who serve in Congress end up as lobbyists, and thousands of their aides do. In fact, that's one of the central stories in my book, The Unwinding. There's a guy named Jeff Conaton who goes from working on Capitol Hill to making a lot of money in a lobbying firm and then kind of being disenchanted with the whole thing. So it's nothing new. I don't know if Bear was saying that that the leaks have something to do with the revolving door or not. Was that his point?
No, he thought that what we were missing is the big story, which is this massive swindle, this massive transfer of wealth since 9/11 from the public coffers into private hands.
Right, right. That has been well reported. Dana Priest of the Washington Post had a series a few years back about the sort of the burgeoning national security state growing around Washington and the huge numbers of jobs and the huge amount of money and the opacity of it all. So, yeah, that's a decade-old story or more, and Bear is right to say that it we've grown so used to it that we no longer talk about it.
Well, it leads me, since I have interviewed Jeff Conaton a few times about matters relating to his experience and particularly about issues involving the new Consumer Protection Bureau. And, of course, he worked with one of the rare senators who didn't take campaign money and who was a lame duck and who decided to serve the American people instead of the special interests.
Right, Ted Kaufman.
Ted Kaufman, right. But it leads me, though, to ask a question which your book certainly stimulates, and that is that is this a reason why we are not a social democracy like a lot of the other European countries, for example, who have a higher standard of living right next door, because Canada, because instead of public money going back to the public in the form of government services, so much of the public money is being siphoned off into private hands. And the reason that happens is that the people who are supposedly giving oversight to what happens to our tax dollars, the Congress, are bought by the rich and powerful.
You know, the suspicion of government goes very deep and very far back in this country, as I'm sure you know, all the way back to the beginning. It's encoded in the DNA, in the Declaration of Independence, in all the ways in which the Constitution makes it very hard to get anything done in government. And that doesn't change. It remains constant. But what does cycle back and forth and move up and down is Americans' willingness to allow government to get strong enough to be a check against private interest and private power. And in my book, I describe how over the past generation, we have taken the limiting of government and the undermining of an idea of a public interest about as far as it can go and still keep the society together. And every year that passes, the bonds that tie Americans together and that create sort of structures where people who are middle class or working class can still thrive are eroding. It hasn't always been that way. I mean, there was a period before the current generation, a period I call the Roosevelt Republic, where there were laws, regulations, institutions, and just norms of behavior that kept private power in check. And those are almost all gone now, and we are very close to being back in the Gilded Age with the robber barons.
So what explains, and your book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, George Packer profiles various people in the South and the Rust Belt, in Washington, D.C., as you mentioned, Jeff Conaton, and in the Silicon Valley. So we've got a cross-section of great American characters here. But what explains then, is it a kind of political version of the Stockholm Syndrome that so many Americans, particularly working Americans, are identifying with the billionaires who don't give a damn about them? How do you explain, for example, the political traction that those who are against Obamacare have?
You know, it goes back to that original antipathy to the center telling people how to live their lives. And that is an old American thing. But it takes on different forms. And right now it's taken on the form of a Republican Party that is not a normal political party any longer. It's acting, you know, more like an ideological movement that doesn't, you know any restraints or boundaries in what it's willing to do in order to advance its own partisan ends, especially on Capitol Hill with the filibuster and other tools, and then in the Tea Party, which is a the movement that sprang up in the face of Obama's election and the financial crisis. So it's not surprising that Obamacare has triggered this huge backlash. But I wouldn't go too far in assessing how much people in, say, the bottom 60% really are hostile to Obama and to government. I think they're hostile to the idea that government has been captured by interests, not just corporations, but, you know, some people point to the teachers' unions, some people point, you know, to partisan political groups. What I found in reporting my book in places like North Carolina and Ohio is a general sense that big people, the people at the top, well-connected players, have got the game rigged, and little people are bound to lose and are suckers for thinking that if they just continue to play by the rules, they can begin to get ahead. And that is a really serious threat to the idea of, you know, upward mobility and equal opportunity. And I think their government may be seen as maybe as just one more big player, one more big institution that doesn't particularly care about little people, but the others are just as are regarded with just as much hostility. The Wall Street banks, multinational corporations, you know, Walmart and Bank of America are just as unpopular among many of the people that I met in my travels as Congress and the White House.
And you have to add to that list Monsanto.
Absolutely. For people who care about what goes into their food, and more people do. And I met one of the characters in my book is a guy in North Carolina named Dean Price, who is the son of very conservative Bible Belt tobacco farmers, but he becomes a kind of radicalized evangelist for biodiesel fuel and for local food, simply because he looks around at the countryside where he lives and sees nothing but depredation and decay and big box stores and multinational oil companies. So this is a conservative man who's been radicalized by these upheavals of the last decade or two. And I think that is a widespread feeling. There's a real divide between elites and, you know, large numbers of ordinary Americans like Dean Price.
Again, I'm speaking with George Packer, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, who covered the Iraq War for the magazine, and his book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, was named one of the 10 best books of 2005 by The New York Times. His latest book just out is The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. So if indeed our current president means well but is circumscribed by the power elite, by this sort of new oligarchy that has captured our politics and the plutocracy who's turned our economy into a plutonomy, do you think that it would be helpful if he actually had that debate with the American people? You're saying it's in the subtext, in the subconscious of all the people that you traveled around and interviewed in your new book, The Unwinding. Because, you know, the liberals have pretty much given up on this guy because he's not the miracle worker they expected.
Yeah, and they expected too much because one president, you know, one very good man who could have been a very good, maybe a great president at another time, couldn't. It turned out that the institutions were the real problem. It wasn't just who was in the White House. You know, here he had both houses of Congress and was barely able to get a reform package passed. And it passed, you know, in such an ugly fashion and with such half measures. I mean, the health care bill is a landmark bill, but it could have been a lot better. And it had many near-death experiences. So there's something institutionally blocking a president who wants to reform the country and to, you know, create more widespread and shared prosperity. And that's what Obama's up against. And I fault him for this or that tactical mistake and maybe for believing for too long that he could bring the Republicans to a sane and normal position. But really, there's such larger, long-term problems that Obama, you know, was powerless to really do much about.
And in terms of the economy, you've got this character from Silicon Valley, and of course out here in California, we're, you know, a blue state that's looking towards the 21st century, and much of the rest of the country in terms of red states are going back to the 14th century. But the character that you portray here, who put up the seed money for Facebook,
And founded PayPal, right.
He was influenced by a French writer in a book that was published in 1967 that talked about America being a dynamic force of technology and education. And, of course, that certainly strikes one as a great irony, given that California's education was the world leader back when he wrote that.
Yeah.
And now it's down there with Mississippi at the bottom. But I guess the overall point about this libertarian character is that the creation of the virtual world from Silicon Valley has taken the place of advances in the physical world. So
This is Peter Thiel, and he's a bit younger than I am, but like me, he grew up in what's now called Silicon Valley, although it wasn't then. And he's a very conservative libertarian who is asking all the right questions about the limits of the information age. I mean, he's become a billionaire through computers and the internet, and yet he asks the simple question, why has the economy stagnated and the middle class declined during the same period as Apple and Google and Facebook have, you know, created billionaires and wonderful gadgets and, you know, changed the way we communicate and live? And his answer is, there's just not enough technological breakthroughs, that these are small things, that, you know, an iPhone is not the same thing as, you know, the space program. So he, you know, he's an elite and certainly wouldn't reshape society the way I would, but it's rare to find someone in Silicon Valley who questions the very premise that the internet, you know, it has changed everything. It's changed everything and changed very little. It's created dazzling new distractions and new tools, and yet there hasn't been much progress in the country in the age of the internet. And that's something I find people in Silicon Valley have a hard time getting their heads around.
Well, I suppose on the plus side with Silicon Valley compared to Wall Street, which seems to be all about extracting money, given that hedge fund billionaires seem to be the people driving and profiting from Wall Street, and they don't produce anything like the old robber barons do. At least the people in Silicon Valley produce things. But
yes, and you know, my book, The Unwinding, looks at both these not famous characters in very much forgotten places, and also at the power centers and people who live and work there, Peter Thiel in Silicon Valley, Wall Street, Jeff Connaughton in Washington, the two sectors that have done very well in this period of the unwinding, the past generation, are Wall Street and Silicon Valley. And, you know, between the two, I am completely with you. I would take Silicon Valley in a heartbeat. I'm just suggesting, you know, that there's a little bit too much hysteria and hype about it. And if you look hard, if you leave the coasts and leave the big cities and go to places like rural North Carolina, where Dean Price lives, or Youngstown, Ohio, this old steel city fallen on very hard times, where another character, Tammy Thomas, lives, or even the Tampa Bay area, which is sort of a character unto itself in the midst of the housing bust, what you find is, you know, people's lives have materially declined, and they know it, and it's really prominent in their minds. The heartland, you know, the conversations in the heartland are very grim. What people say is, there's no more middle class here. There was a middle class when I was growing up, but now there's rich and poor. And we don't think anyone in Washington or in big business cares about that, because they've become, their loyalties have shifted either to organized money or overseas to finding markets abroad. They don't care about American workers or American consumers. That's a very widespread view, and I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between elites and people living in prosperous, you know, places on the coasts or in sort of high-tech centers, and then people in little towns like Madison, North Carolina, and Youngstown, Ohio, where the main streets are pretty much boarded up.
Well, just in closing, George Packer, what are your conclusions here, given that the people that you just talked about seem to have it right, they get it, but whether this will translate into a new Roosevelt Republic or, as I mentioned earlier, the notion of a kind of political version of the Stockholm Syndrome, where you identify with your torturers and, you know, you've got the prosperity gospel being preached throughout all these red states by the evangelists like Joel Osteen, etc. And that's, you know, one, two versions of it, or it'll just continue this country to become more and more of an oligarchy, less of a democracy.
I don't have a good answer for you, but my book is very deliberately a narrative, a big panoramic portrait that consists of intimate stories of individuals. I didn't want to write a policy book because there are many good ones, and in a sense it doesn't matter what I say we should do. You know, what I wanted to do was show us where we are and how we got there over the last generation. So I don't have the 10 fixes that we need, and I'm a bit pessimistic simply because I don't see political and civic institutions that are capable right now of being strong enough to counter organized money. It's not just about a good president or a good book or even good citizens. It's about institutional structures, and we had those, and we let them go. We squandered them. It takes a lot to rebuild them, and I don't know what form they'll be rebuilt in. But one thing I do know is the characters in my book, like Dean and Tammy, have certainly not given up on the American dream. In fact, they're very invested in it, whether or not it's still invested in them. They're still reaching for their piece of it. And so as long as that spark is in them, then we can't count it out.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, George Packer.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with George Packer, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, who covered the Iraq War for the magazine. His book, The Assassin's Gate, America and Iraq, was named one of the 10 best books of 2005 by The New York Times. And he served in the Peace Corps in Togo, West Africa, and was a Guggenheim Fellow. He has written about the atrocities committed in Sierra Leone, civil unrest in the Ivory Coast, the megacity of Lagos, and global counterinsurgency. In 2003, Packer was awarded 2 Overseas Press Club Awards, and his most recent book is Interesting Times, Writing for a Turbulent Decade. And his latest book just out is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time for